Good afternoon. The Secondary Education and Career Development Subcommittee will now come to order. Missy, would you call the roll, please?
Chair McLean?
Here.
Vice Chair Schoaf?
Here.
Ranking Member Bush? Representative Andrade? Representative Benjamin? Representative Barrero?
Here.
Representative Fisher? Representative Gia Lombardo? Representative Harding?
Here.
Representative Maggard?
Here.
Representative Maney?
Here.
Representative Omfroy?
Here.
Representative Rizzo?
Here.
Representative Robinson?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Valdez?
Present.
Representative Woodson?
Here.
Representative Yarborough?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, and let the record reflect that Ranking Member Bush is here. Hey, Member, how are you? Great. And let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all your electronic devices. Chair Payne set a high bar this morning. If your phone goes off because of our need for revenue, we will be taking donations for the general fund. And I don't know how much that will actually mean to us, but all revenue is good. Please be recognized by me before you ask questions or anything else, and we'll recognize you to speak. Remember to push so the microphones are not hot, even though there's a green button on there. They are not hot. You have to push the button to make it hot. Good afternoon, members. I'd like to welcome you to the Secondary Education and Career Development Subcommittee. Normally, at our first meeting, we would take time at the beginning to introduce ourselves. However, since our time is limited, I'd like for us to get started and go straight to work and begin discussing some important issues that I believe will come up this session. If time permits, we'll take time at the end to introduce ourselves. Last week, you received an email from me describing the goal of this committee and documentation you all should have read. We will continue this method of communication for all pre-meeting materials, so please come prepared. As I discussed in my email, we have a need for identifying credentials that are valued in Florida's labor market. There's a growing need for people to attain credentials that will help them obtain better jobs. We need to develop better criteria for identifying these credentials so that the public and employers can determine which ones to use. With that, we have a panel discussion set up today, and I'd like to move right into that. Our first presentation will be by Ms. Amy Ellen Duke Benfield, Senior Fellow at the National Skills Coalition, who will discuss ways that states can identify quality credentials. Members, during this presentation, if you'd like to ask questions, please try to wave me down somehow, and we'll make sure that happens. We've got a little technology going on, but we're going to work it out. Sure. There she is. Okay. Ms. Benfield, you're recognized.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm going to share some slides with you right now. But before I get started, I really appreciate having the opportunity to speak to you all today. The National Skills Coalition is a broad-based coalition working toward a vision of America that grows its economy by investing in its people so that every worker in every industry has the skills to compete and prosper. We engage in organizing, advocacy, and communications to advance state and federal policies that support these goals, policies that are based on the on-the-ground experience of our members. So obviously you're having this hearing today because you know that credentials matter. More than ever, post-secondary education and training has become essential to the nation's economic mobility and growth. More than 80% of all jobs in today's economy require some form of education and training, and virtually all jobs created since the 2008 Great Recession have gone to those with at least some post-secondary education and training. As a nation, America is not keeping pace, though, with the accelerating demands that employers have demanded that we get more skilled labor. fewer than half of all Americans have a post-secondary degree or credentials, and credentials are helping states respond to the future of work, which ironically enough, in the middle of COVID, rather than being something that was 5 or 10 years off, is now actually in our backyards today. States are responding by setting attainment goals, which I know Florida has done, and making investments that increase the number of adults with credentials of value. If we want to build an inclusive economy where all workers and businesses have the skills they need to stay competitive in a rapidly changing global marketplace, we must work together to expand access to and the attainment of credentials of value. Briefly, I'm not going to walk through this whole slide here, but I know that you all should have copies of the slides. But what this does here is talks about the different types of non-degree credentials. And so when I say non-degree credentials for the purposes of our work today, I'm talking about certificates, apprenticeship certificates, industry certifications, and licenses. Recent research from the Credential Engine suggests there are 750,000 unique credentials in the United States. I know Florida contributes quite a few to some of those. It can be difficult for working adults and other non-traditional students to understand their options and the likely employment and earnings outcomes associated with specific programs. Non-registered apprenticeships are growing, for instance, but they're largely untracked. DOL is launching a new system of industry-recognized apprenticeships that will operate alongside the registered apprenticeship system. So right there, we have two areas of non-degree credentials. Many of you are familiar with certificates, which may be for credit or non-credit, which I know Florida has been very active in, on workforce or continuing ed. And then there are occupational licenses that each state requires persons participating in specific professions, like being a plumber, being a nurse, and to first obtain a professional occupational license from a state licensing or occupational licensing board. The key characteristics of non-degree credentials are mainly that they're rapidly growing, but sometimes hard to measure. They are nimble. A significant share of the workforce holds a college or a professional certification or license. It is more common for non-degree credentials to be earned by Black students when compared to degrees. And non-degree credentials can lead to increased earnings, but the effects vary greatly based on type and demographics. But not all non-degree credentials are equal, as I noted in the last slide, because quality varies. Some connect individuals to good careers, while others offer little to no economic payoff. In addition, they can have inequitable outcomes by race. Some connect individuals to good careers. Others are terminal credentials with little or no economic payoff. Wage gains vary by sector. In the certificate space, sectors that pay off include engineering, mechanical or technical areas, law enforcement, among others. There are other areas, though, like early childhood ed, that don't pay off as well. States need criteria to assess the quality of non-degree credentials to make sensible budget and policy decisions, advance equity, and put students on a path to success. So the National Skills Coalition at the beginning of 2019 decided that it was going to, with foundation funding, we'd been approached by a few funders, to develop a project to define quality criteria for non-degree credentials. As I said, with roughly 750,000 credentials out there, it's kind of the Wild West, and there's an acknowledgement at both the state level, the federal level, and I would say at local institutional levels that we need to have a better grasp of what quality means. Several types of non-degree credentials do have specific quality assurance processes in place. For example, for-credit programs offered at institutions of higher ed, like your colleges, are generally subject to state and regional accreditation requirements, while apprenticeship programs are usually registered through either the USDOL or a designated state agency or council, and state licensing requirements are set by state agencies or bodies. But there is a whole set of credentials out there that live in an environment in which there are not quality standards, or the quality standards are relatively low. In developing the quality non-degree credential definition, NSC began by consulting with 6 states who had undertaken significant policy efforts around defining or supporting quality standards for non-degree programs. The consensus criteria were developed through NSC's work with agency leaders from 12 states that included from each of the original six states, governor's staff, the chief workforce officer, and then the chief post-secondary officer for the state, as well as related departments such as K through 12, economic development, or the community technical college system. The consensus criteria were then vetted through NSC's work with other workforce and higher ed organizations that have more national scope, as well as those interested in racial equity. The six original states that we worked with were Alabama, Iowa, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, and Washington. Each of those states had already explored how they were using employment earnings and competencies to set quality standards. Their intents were different though. For instance, Tennessee was looking at transitions between secondary and post-secondary and industry recognized credentials. Virginia and Iowa had both developed their criteria in response to having financial aid programs, state financial aid programs that cover some types of these programs. Once we developed in conjunction with these original six states, then we vetted the definition with six more states, one of which included Florida. These states were in the process of developing their processes or had a process for one funding stream that wasn't as comprehensive or wide-reaching as some of the others. We also sought feedback, as I noted, from research and advocacy organizations, as well as those with a racial equity mission. The criteria, the other five states in addition to Florida were Colorado, Louisiana, Oregon, Rhode Island, and West Virginia. The criteria should allow state policymakers to be comfortable supporting these programs with public funds as the economy recovers from the COVID-19 recession. Students to be confident about selecting high quality training that leads to good employment, and employers to understand which programs are effectively preparing students for careers. I can't underscore enough the unified message I heard from governor's offices, particularly around economic development and the interest in ensuring that they're developing quality standards for these programs, because these programs are nimble and responsive to the needs of the labor market. Briefly, before I dive into the four criteria that the states agreed upon, are the general principles that we started out with from our conversations with the various folks from states. One, the definition should be student focused. Two, the definition should support equitable credential attainment. Equity is at the core of this work, especially because we know in the past that students of color have not been ill-served by some poorer quality non-degree credential programs, I would say. Another principle is that information about credentials should be valid and transparent. That's something that I know Florida is particularly interested in and has done a great job on the for-credit side. There should be flexibility in operationalizing the definition while still safeguarding quality, and states and localities should have a public process in doing so. I am aware of the recent work that's been done to develop tighter quality standards for the K through 12 or secondary CAPE career and professional education industry recognized credential certifications, and that work is coming along and now being expanded upon. I will say one advantage of having transparent criteria with clear processes in place is that it makes it harder for providers to make the case for exceptions. For instance, if you're applying criteria that is commonly agreed upon and recognized in public and was developed in a fair, transparent space, it is easier to enforce than what happens with those programs that don't meet these criteria. So the consensus criteria that we did develop with the 12 states landed on four prime areas. I will walk through each of these criteria now. The first one is evidence of substantial job opportunities. States who've adopted quality credential definitions have taken a variety of approaches to define substantial job opportunities, including selecting occupations in high demand, high wage industries, as we've seen in Nevada, have long-term projected growth, that was particularly important to Virginia, or identified as an emerging occupation important to the state's economy, which I know is a criteria that Florida has considered in the past. This might be particularly important in identifying critical credentials in your state and responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Getting input from employers is part of this criteria. Many states leverage existing structures like workforce development boards or employer advisory committees and economic development staff, as I mentioned earlier, to validate the credentials are needed by employers. One state, Alabama, is conducting a large-scale employer survey to validate credentials and competencies. South Dakota did something recently with roughly 200 employers. Going back to CAPE, I know that it is linked to an occupation that is included in the workforce system's targeted occupational list, or as I'd mentioned, an occupation that is emerging. The second criteria is a little bit more aspirational, I would say, in terms of being one of the required criteria being transparent evidence of the competencies mastered by credential holders. Most states who have adopted a quality credential definition indicated that it should be skills-based, with standard assessments and certifications awarded by a third-party entity like a professional group, industry, or government agency. One state adds to this definition by noting that competencies must be based on standards developed or endorsed by employers. And one state also looks at the personal effectiveness, academic, workplace, industry, sector, occupation, and management competencies gained with the credential. So really does a pretty detailed look under the hood of what each of these credentials entails. A universal agreement, though, was that it should be based on learning outcomes, not dependent on the credit hour, the clock hour, or more time-based standards of academic measurement. The next required criteria has to do with evidence of the employment and earnings outcomes of individuals after receiving the credential. So states can leverage their longitudinal data systems that include administrative wage data to support the outcomes reporting of quality credentials. Generally, we see states looking at employment and earnings outcomes that align with existing reporting timelines, like those required by the eligible training provider list. And people are oftentimes updating these data maybe once a year or so. It depends on how nimble you want to be. Obviously, there's noise in some of the data at times, so you might not want to think about putting all your eggs in one basket when you see unusual demand, like we have seen in some places around, let's say, contract tracing under COVID. But the idea is that you're looking at that data to tell you what people are earning when they get out into the labor market. I think it's important to underscore here is whether this information is available to consumers and students to help them make a decision about what kind of credential they're going to be pursuing and how you're measuring this information right now. One thing I encourage you all to think about carefully is an earnings threshold. This is what oftentimes states move to when they're thinking about employment and earnings. And what do you think an appropriate performance standard is for earnings? Is the threshold based on the average earnings achieved by those with a high school diploma the right way to think about it? I think that's the way that Florida had been thinking about it with CAPE versus average wage gain from prior job to post. But then this raises the question of what about high-value jobs that offer low salaries? We know that early childhood ed often starts at around, if we're lucky, $12 to $13 an hour. There are other jobs that are high in demand and that folks use to get into industries that don't pay as well as others. And there are jobs that are social good jobs. For instance, I would be, as someone who lives in New York City, I would be horrified if we were told that we could no longer train for CNAs when about 900,000 people in New York City environment and the area are in CNAs and related professions. And so it's important to think about what exceptions there should be. And also as well to think about what are the regional differences across your economy. I know that Florida has several economic regions and that this is something that's worth keeping in mind when you're thinking about rural and urban split as well. And then the final criteria is stackability. And you might say, why is that strongly preferred? The states agreed, and actually this was one area that Florida weighed in pretty heavily, that there are too many questions and obvious exceptions like registered apprenticeships, which meet the first three criteria, but don't necessarily stack to higher levels of education. to have a quality definition requires stackability, but everyone agreed that stackability was core, especially as we think about equity, whether that's gender equity, racial equity around disability, but that it's important that we not send folks into credentials that lead to dead ends. Stackable credentials can help individuals advance in education and employment and can be particularly important for people of color and who enroll in non-degree credentials as their first rung on the education ladder. It is essential that non-degree credentials articulate with additional education and training. Keep in mind that a state can implement the criteria using a composite rating. A state could consider including the four criteria in a qualitative or quantitative composite rating. States could establish some way of quantifying a score on each criterion and then combine the scores. We've actually worked with states on that. States might qualitatively consider the criteria and a credential strength in each before determining whether it is a quality credential. That gets into some of that discussion that I brought up around early childhood ed and that kind of thing. The rating could be expressed by a number of stars, which is what some states have done. And then you could also combine the criteria in a composite rating that in a way that a weakness in one criterion might be offset by a strength in another. So what does all this work lead up to? In a certain way, what we're talking about is developing a list of quality programs to align and support performance accountability is one purpose. For instance, with WIOA or the Perkins Act approved programs, I know you have multiple education and training funding streams in Florida, multiple areas in which which non-degree credentials are being granted. And the question becomes, are they all living by the same criteria? Not yet at this point. The other advantage of having a common list or consensusly agreed upon list is to provide guidance then to the state of where to invest resources. And then in combination with other policies to increase the number of residents with quality credentials. Having a comprehensive agreed upon list is important, but it's not going to solve the quality or demand problem by itself. Florida would need to build a policy structure around that list. I want to briefly go over a couple policy recommendations that I have for you all as you're thinking about walking down this road. In terms of codifying or regulating quality criteria, you need to provide adequate resources for implementation, including work to validate credentials, which I was just talking about, and to track employment earnings data, and ensure that data is collected in a way that allows for disaggregation by key demographic data, such as race and ethnicity. You could consider requiring a periodic review of how the definition is implemented to ensure that it's keeping pace with the changing labor market, demographic demands, and student protections. One key set of policy decisions facing states is determining which programs or policies will be covered by the criteria. The entities within the state that are responsible for developing and implementing the criteria and the process by which the criteria will be established. States should begin with some consideration of what programs and policies the criteria will be used to support. Like I said, you could go pretty broad, you could go more narrowly. Round one states develop their quality criteria for a range of different purposes, including eligibility for federal or state training funds, support for programmatic performance accountability systems, and for evaluating overall progress towards state attainment goals. However, in most cases, these criteria are not being used to support multiple state policies or priorities. Adopting criteria that can be applied across multiple programs and systems can support greater alignment between education, workforce, and human services investments, and can create efficiencies. Without consistency, states will have a list of quality credentials that vary from one purpose to the other. Once the determination has been made about which programs we covered by the criteria, a critical next step is determining which entity or entities within the state will be responsible for developing, implementing, and revising the criteria. For around one state's primary responsibility for establishing the criteria generally sits with the state educational agency and or a state workforce agency. However, round one states draw on expertise from a range of stakeholders, including partner agencies and employers in key industries. States should take steps to ensure that the development and implementation of the definition is transparent to stakeholders, including education and training providers, consumers, and the general public. I also want to underscore that there are a set of state policies to support quality non-degree credential attainment. All these are particularly important for equity considerations. For instance, expanding financial aid or other training fund, expanding non-tuition supports like childcare and transportation, expanding career counseling capacity, guided pathways, supporting development of industry partnerships, and expanding apprenticeships and other work-based learning models, as well as supporting stackable credentials. And on the data front, data policies can also help track and further equity efforts. For instance, it's essential that you collect broad data about all post-secondary programs by leveraging your state longitudinal data system data, collecting and using demographic data on completers, and then also around non-degree credentials, it's important to produce or use existing consumer information tools to promote quality non-degree credentials. I have a few state examples that I was going to go through, but I'm aware of my time, so I can table those for now and maybe return back to them during the Q&A. Thank you.
Ms. Benfield, how long do you think it would take for you to run through a couple of those examples?
Oh, just about 3 minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Please.
Now, NSC is working with a set of 6 states as part of a quality post-secondary credential policy academy. It includes Alabama, Colorado, Louisiana, New Jersey, Oregon, and Virginia. Through the academy, state agency teams made up of higher education, K-12, workforce development, economic development, human services, as well as the governor's office are coming together to advance a high quality post-secondary skills strategy so that more residents can attain quality credentials. 4 states so far have adopted and are operationalizing, I should say, the consensus criteria, and the other 2 will shortly. I want to highlight a couple states briefly. First, Louisiana. Last fall, the Louisiana Board of Regents became the 4th state to adopt the quality criteria, building on the participation of other states ahead of them. A leadership team was comprised of representatives of the Louisiana Board of Regents, the Louisiana Community and Technical College System, the Louisiana Workforce Commission, Louisiana's Economic Development Organization, and the Louisiana Department of Education, along with various other smaller agencies and organizations, including advocacy organizations that work with people in the community. For Louisiana, a certificate or an industry-based certification will be considered quality post-secondary credential of value if it meets the consensus criteria and leads directly to an occupation that, at a minimum, maintains a 20% wage premium over a high school diploma in Louisiana. Louisiana also developed 2 categories of credentials through this process, acknowledging that individuals start their post-secondary pathways on different points. And I want to underscore this because I think sometimes states can say, we want all of these quality credentials to lead to high wage, high demand jobs. But there are some folks in your populace who can't go just from the first non-degree credential leading into a high-wage job, and actually need a ladder to get there. And so they developed 2 categories of credentials through the process, acknowledging that folks start the post-secondary pathway at different points. And so they developed a quality post-secondary credential value classification and an on-ramp credential classification. And though an on-ramp credential does not meet the credentials of value standards they established, it provides a means for individuals with lower skills to get on a training pathway and build toward a higher level credential. Colorado and Oregon are also considering operationalizing an on-ramp credential definition that then will be required to stack onto a more quality definition. Colorado, which was led by the Department of Education, convened a team representing the Workforce Development Council, the Colorado Community College System, the Department of Education, training providers, education nonprofits, and an advocacy organization to adopt a quality definition, identify top non-degree credentials, and develop a cross-agency policy agenda. Colorado worked from an opportunity statement that this work helps develop a unified system to identify and track number of quality non-degree credentials and as a way to develop skills to fill the state's talent pipeline and attainment goals. After reaching a consensus definition on quality, Colorado created a process map to understand what systems hold data on non-degree credentials within the state and what policy changes or new rules need to be established to integrate these data into the state's data trust that will support the collection of quality of data around quality non-degree credentials. Our early indicators, you'll hear the echoes through what I just talked about regarding Louisiana and Colorado, are the essential components I just want to leave you with as you go forward on this work. And that is the importance of bringing together cross-agency systems to work on this. And then also the fact that states are beginning to wrestle with how this definition applies when you think about adult learners who might have lower skills versus traditional high school students, and whether essential jobs such as early childhood ed and that sort of thing should be included. So that concludes my remarks. I appreciate the opportunity here today and look forward to hearing from Mike Krause next.
Ms. Benfield, thank you for your presentation. Members, are there any questions? Any questions? There aren't. Again, thank you for your presentation today and all that information. Obviously, it's a lot to take in, but we appreciate it. And next up, members, we'll have Mike Krause. He's the former director of the Tennessee Higher Education Commission. Mr. Krause will discuss some of the processes Tennessee has already implemented, including impetus for the work their state underwent, challenges encountered along the way, and the results, outcomes of the changes that they made. Mr. Krause, you are recognized to present your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to confirm that the committee can see my slide deck?
Yes, we can.
Very good. Mr. Chairman and the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to share really briefly the Tennessee story. As the chairman mentioned, about a month ago, I was the chief of higher education for our state. I've since moved on in the private sector at Bradley Aaron Bolt Cummings. And what I'd like to do over the next few minutes is just share how our state progressed through the continuum that you've just heard from Ms. Benfield, and also to talk about how crucial I believe this work is in order to ensure that people can get a great job and support their families. And just to be clear with the committee, I'm in no way advocating for any specific piece of legislation, but rather sharing what our experience in Tennessee was. I think it's always helpful in public policy to start with why. And in Tennessee, we started with why because we realized that going to work with just a high school diploma was not a path to a living wage. As I worked as the chief of our higher education system for about 4.5 years, I consistently heard throughout our state people that would say, well, not everybody needs to go to college. And typically, I was able to clarify that by saying, but what if college meant a welding certificate? What if college meant something below the traditional university pathway? But there did remain some who believed that a high school diploma was sufficient in order to enter the workforce and support a family. And so I've shared this data with you that you see here because it makes clear that's not true. At least in Tennessee, when we grabbed our high school graduates from 2014, we can look at what they're making right now. And if you went into the workforce immediately after high school, only 20% of those students are earning more than minimum wage. So when I start with why, around why we've got to make sure that we have a high wage pipeline for students that has fully aligned workforce credentials like Ms. Benfield just shared with you, this is why it's important. Because we want more than 20% of our students to earn minimum wage. And this data makes clear that a high school diploma, at least in Tennessee, wasn't sufficient to do that. The second point I want to make around why is that we were able to take a really important look at our counties. And so we have 95 counties in our state, and we organized these counties in a data set according to the percent of their population that had a college degree. And this data tells a very clear story, right? That if you were in a high attainment county, your per capita income increased. If you were in a low attainment county, let's look at those over on the left side. They actually lost jobs during this time period. Here's what worries me about that. This time period that we reviewed was actually the fastest piece of economic growth in American history. And if you were one of our counties here on the left side of this graph, with a low number of your residents with a credential beyond high school, you actually lost jobs during one of the most explosive periods of job growth in American history. To us, that is why the work of defining a credential of value was so important, because we wanted to offer our residents and our communities a future other than what you see on the left side of the graph. We faced some challenges though, and Dr. Benfield did a great job of laying some of those out. And I just want to walk through the challenges we faced and how we addressed them in Tennessee. The first challenge, how do you define a credential of value? Dr. Benfield walked through a lot of that. In Tennessee, it looked like four things. First, we realized that the occupation had to be growing. And the good news is Tennessee, like Florida, had a pretty robust repository of data that we were able to see. Is this field forecasted to grow over the next 10 years? Second, utilizing our state workforce department, we were able to make sure that the number of vacancies in a given job had at least equal or less than the number of applicants. So there were documented vacancies. Three, we need these occupations to have an entry-level wage above $28,000. As a now private citizen and no longer a state employee, I'm more free to speak, and I'll tell you that I thought $28,000 was too low, that a family being expected to subsist on $28,000 probably wasn't realistic. But that is a criteria we settled on because eventually we had to decide on something. And then the fourth piece would be it had to require at least a high school diploma in order to enter the field. That solution to that challenge, though, led us to another challenge. There are few states as diverse as Florida, as I've learned working with many Floridians. I will tell you, I think Tennessee is pretty diverse too, though. We really have three distinct regions. And on the west side of the state, we have West Tennessee, which is a Delta region anchored by Memphis. In Middle Tennessee, we have something resembling, in some part, the Orlando area, which is largely suburban, anchored by Nashville. And then in rural East Tennessee, there is no doubt you are in Appalachia. And so we quickly began to realize that educational attainment varies across the state. And we also began to realize that what FedEx needed in Memphis isn't the same thing that Eastman Chemical needs in Upper East Tennessee. We began working through that problem and we realized a couple things. First, just saying that we need 10 types of fields statewide wasn't going to help. So we needed to be able to focus on regional needs. We also realized a really important policy lever that I want to share with you. We won't have the chance to dive into it deeply, but I at least want to socialize the idea within this committee that every state has two streams of funding that are ideally suited for these credentials. First, you have the Workforce Investment Opportunity Act. And second, you have the Perkins Act. So both of these are federally guided vehicles that provide funding directly to states in order to help put, in your case, Floridians to work in great jobs. And here's what's interesting. In both the case of WIOA and Perkins, the state is delegated the administrative authority in many ways to decide which fields work and which fields can receive funding under these programs. The reason this is important is something I would hazard any state to avoid, is try not to have one list of in-demand occupations for WIOA and one list of in-demand occupations for Perkins. We've managed to get that merged to some extent in Tennessee. I will tell you, it is a powerful vehicle to make sure if you are trying to communicate with the average Floridian about the need for them to obtain an in-demand credential, the reality is we might have a minute with that Floridian to communicate the importance. It is paramount that we communicate clearly about what exactly is in demand. And anytime you have WIOA messages on one side and Perkins messages on the other, I think we lose some ground. So in Tennessee, we tried to merge those lists, and we also tried to realize that what you need in Memphis might not be the same thing that you need in Knoxville. And here was the result, and we're really proud of this work. So you'll see here, and obviously you probably can't read the table, but we issued by region in the state empirically proven vacancies that we knew are open and have that annual wage above $28,000 that I mentioned. This has been a powerful conversation change in Tennessee for a couple different groups. One, I think some of the hardest working state employees, at least in my experience in Tennessee, were our unemployment benefit counselors. You think about how difficult it is every day to talk to people who are out of work trying to support a family. I believe this was a powerful tool, and I know for a fact on the front lines at what our Tennessee career centers, when a Tennessean is coming in to seek unemployment insurance benefits, we're able to quickly pivot and say, here, let's think about getting you back to work. And yes, in Tennessee, we have a unique program that we're able to say, not only can we get you back to work, but in Tennessee, if you're a displaced worker, you're going to be able to go to technical or community college tuition free via a program called Tennessee Reconnect, which I can talk about in depth. But for us, it was really important to craft a solution that equipped frontline state employees doing really hard jobs, and ultimately to make sure that a Tennessean who's facing a really difficult situation is equipped with this information to say, hey, these are the jobs in demand. This is what I can make. And yes, we have the unique opportunity to offer that Tennessean the chance to go back and train in one of these fields for free. Allied to that, everything that we sought to devise, when we took a look at how do we define an in-demand credential, which in-demand list do we use, we tried to build a pipeline with an end in mind. And I want to close just by sharing a real-world example. So for those of you that don't know, on the left, you are looking at what we in higher education know as a CNC machine. And it's made by a company called Haas. And what a CNC machine does is it manufactures basically everything that you and I use in our everyday lives. But the most important thing a CNC machine does that I came to learn is a CNC machine is an opportunity machine. Because if you know how to operate a CNC machine in Tennessee, you are starting at $25 an hour. And by the way, you can do that with an 8-month technical credential that you can gain at one of our colleges. We tried to build a pipeline that led students to places where you know you're starting at $25 an hour. You know that there's an opportunity to have a trade that's going to be stable and in demand over the course of the next decade. I think the challenge you all face as legislators and I faced in my previous role in Tennessee is oftentimes these policy discussions can become very abstract. And it's very easy to lose touch with the tangible effect that education and workforce development have on a family and on their life and on their kids. And I tried to remember that if we could get the right occupations in front of the right Tennesseans, they would ultimately find themselves being able to do something like operate one of these CNC machines and go on to do the proverbial American dream. And so as we're thinking through these data points that can be convoluted, they can be complex, I tried to always remember that. And I'd also say this work is happening. As Dr. Benfield shared, there are states doing this work. I'm proud of the work we accomplished in Tennessee. We still have a lot further to go. But I believe at its core, today's hearing around in-demand credentials is really one about opportunity. And it's an opportunity also for public policy to be able to hew to what it is people need to make a better future. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my formal remarks.
Mr. Krause, thank you for your presentation. Members, do you have any questions for Mr. Krause or Ms. Benfield? Representative Andrade?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Krause, for your presentation. Going back to your slide six, the regional workforce demand, the 2018 annual wage, and I apologize if I missed it, is that the average starting salary, or is that the average salary for that industry?
That was the average salary, sir, within the first 3 years of entering the workforce.
Thank you very much. When you mentioned the $28,000 being too low, I was curious what you would think would be, in your estimate, a preferred starting salary number, and if you think the focus on starting salary versus average salary for that industry is something to be considered.
So we didn't get that far, Representative. We were in our nascent stages, and to be completely honest, the work that got us here was long and hard, right? We had to get a lot of people to agree on a lot of things. It is an excellent jumping off point in my mind for a state that wants to do this work, because the reality is, and Florida is a perfect example of this, that a living wage in Putnam County, Tennessee is not a living wage in Davidson County, Tennessee. So there's really a great opportunity to build on and surpass what Tennessee did, in my opinion, that as you think about regional credentials, you also think in terms of a living wage regionally as well. And the good news, Florida, you all should know, you are well recognized for your data quality throughout the nation. People know Florida has great data, and you have state agencies that know how to share that data. And I think that the point you make is a really great next opportunity, because again, somebody in Seminole County, Florida, obviously has a very different life perspective than someone who is located in the panhandle and vice versa. So we have an opportunity, I think, probably to provide some nuance here for families as they seek to make the decision.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Krause, for your presentation. My question has to do with the number of students, the high number of students who are entering the workforce after high school. You quoted a number of 20,381 for Tennessee. Is there anything that is being done, seeing the high volume of students that are entering the workforce and really earning a minimum wage? Is there anything that is being done to address the environment that those students are coming from, to address the issues, the family issues that is part of them going into the workforce so early as opposed to going either to college or going to somewhere else? So are you working also on that piece of the equation?
Yes, ma'am. And Representative, I would tell you that the question you asked, in America, virtually any student who is considered low income can go to any community college tuition free. But as you alluded to, Representative, that's not the problem oftentimes. We have students that are seeking costs of attendance issues. We have students that need to go to work to support their families. Mm-hmm. What we tried to do are two things, and I think there's a couple different approaches. What worked for us was clearing up our messaging with our students who perhaps were high need or low income to make clear to them that this narrative that they face oftentimes is, because my family is low income, I can't go to college. And you all in the committee likely know it's actually the opposite. Because your family is low income and you are eligible for the full Pell Award of $6,400 this year, you absolutely can go to college in terms of the tuition and fee side. So the first piece of this intervention, to your point, Representative, about the environment they come from, I think is about creating a possibility of hope that if these students are first-generation students, their parents may not understand the Pell Grant resources. The second piece, though, is the hardest work, and that is ensuring that we don't just look at going to college as being about tuition, because it isn't. It's about students eating and food insecurity. It's about a student's ability to get to class, oftentimes in a metro area, ensuring that they're able to have public transportation resources. The way we've approached that in Tennessee, I will tell you, it's not been as uniform as I would have liked. It is campus by campus to some extent, but we've got three campuses right now, and I can assure you, and you all likely know that Miami-Dade College is a national model mm-hmm. for low-income student interventions and the work that's been done there. What we try to do is address the whole student when they come in. That's a mindset shift. That is a mind shift change for higher education, because for so many years, I think we viewed ourselves as our job is to get you in, help you get a degree, and get you out. What we're seeing more and more, and what works, is the whole student approach. And this is psychosocial emotional. It means that when the student's sitting in front of a financial aid counselor, we don't just talk to them about the Pell Grant. We talk to them, we ask them the hard question, are you food insecure right now? Are you homeless right now? And those intake questions being, I would tell you every single college, I hope in Florida, has integrated as part of their financial aid screening process, those social emotional questions, because the reality is this, in many situations, we are not short of resources to help these students. We aren't doing a good enough job. I can only speak for Tennessee. We did not do a good enough job, in my opinion, of leading students to the resources.
Mr. Krause, could you stop sharing your screen so that we could see you?
Oh, excuse me. Yes,
it's okay.
Sir.
Okay. It's all right. Are there any other questions yet, Representative? You're recognized.
Yes, this is Representative Christopher Benjamin from Miami. Did you guys consider the message of people not just wanting to go to college, not wanting to spend some additional years in learning some area of education? And Florida, we utilize magnet programs, and in a lot of schools, you're able to get a certificate when you graduate from high school. This delivery system kind of addresses the issue of being employable when they graduate from high school. For those students who aren't interested and continuing to have to go to school, did you guys consider this as you went through this process?
Yes, sir. I'll direct the committee's attention, if you get a chance, to research something called the GIVE Act. And it was directed exactly at Representative Benjamin's point. So we understand that, try as we may, there are students that just aren't going to be able to progress to post-secondary. So it's then incumbent on us to make sure that we are delivering career and technical education, such as the magnets program you described, sir, that allows the student to graduate with a credential of value. And so I'll defer to Dr. Benfield, because these credentials of value, I have to tell you, I've come to believe I'm agnostic on when they're delivered. If they're delivered to a student while they're still in high school, I think that's a win. And I think that we should look more, and we have looked more in Tennessee, at ensuring that career and technical education in our high schools does provide a pathway to one of the credentials that the National Skills Coalition believes is of value. Dr. Benfield?
Thanks, Mike, for that. I think we're seeing an increasing number of states thinking about even dual enrollment differently. Dual enrollment has often been thought about, sending someone when they're in high school, they're able then to take some classes, like they're really good at biology, so they're going to take some college level biology classes or college level English classes and that kind of thing. But states are being much more strategic now about thinking about how do we bring some of that technical education into the high school secondary environment so that students can be pursuing dual enrollment and it not simply lead to credits that they have when they go to the local community college, but is also leading to credits that they have in community technical college and industry recognized credential. And so I think that that's an incredibly important point that you're making, and that in the midst of that, it's important then to make sure that you're providing lots of information to the students around what jobs are in demand, what career pathways would present themselves upon receipt of that credential. And then to also be mindful of the fact that we're not tracking, which unfortunately our history in career and technical education, unfortunately, has some unfortunate underpinnings of tracking of students of color into occupational training programs. But I would argue that in the environment in which we're in now, there are plenty of ways that we can safeguard students to ensure that they're getting a quality credential and can get a good job when they get out of high school.
Mr. Krause, I have a question. So once you identified the credentials, how did Tennessee as a state use the credentials to get more Tennesseans involved in the programs?
Yes, sir. First and foremost, we built programs around the credentials. And so the GIVE Act, any Tennessee student gets 4 free college courses while they're still in high school, if it's in one of those high need fields. So it did require us, Chairman, to adjust our financial aid programs to recognize that there are credentials that have some inherent value, and that offering students the opportunity to engage in those courses, there's absolutely no allure greater than free. And when you're able to tell those students these courses are free, and it is a win-win because you're engaging in a high demand field by definition in order to receive the GIVE Act scholarship, that's probably the most powerful one, Chairman. I will tell you, higher education, and I can say this because I'm a higher educator, has a hard time sometimes reconciling that there are credentials that have more inherent value. And we went ahead and crossed that Rubicon in our state, and I'm glad, because I think it helped the message that we were giving to students to be more clear. And I was able to sleep at night knowing maybe the student that never has anyone else in their family gone to college, they were able to engage in dual enrollment for free, like Dr. Benfield mentioned, and it was only in a high need field. So if the last time we ever saw that student was during high school dual enrollment, they had a really good 2-year sequence that led them to a credential of value.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Very quickly, because we're running up against the clock here. So if it can just very quickly, please.
Okay. I'll make it very quick. My question is for Dr. Benfield. Part of the principle of quality non-degree credentials is having a public process. I know you mentioned Florida in the 6th state. Can you elaborate a little bit for me on that, on the Florida public process?
As short as possible, Dr. Benfield, thank you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to need to refer you to someone else because I wasn't involved in that process. The Education Strategy Group worked with Florida on in terms of developing credentials of value list around the CAPE program. But there did seem, when we worked with the state, when we interviewed stakeholders across the state 1.5 years ago, related to this project, there was great interest in trying to trying to compress, and as Mr. Krause referred to, trying to make parallel, make coordinated these lists so that you don't have five or six lists floating around, which makes it confusing for the consumer as well as the employer. And so would just encourage you to whatever activities are going on right now around developing quality criteria, that as many stakeholders be involved as possible to ensure that you're going to be communicating a comprehensive message, a cohesive message across the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms.
Ms. Benfield and Mr. Krause, thank you so much for your presentations today. We're up against the clock a little bit, but we appreciate the information. It's certainly great food for thought, and certainly some great things to be able to think about from a policy perspective for Florida. So thank you both for your presentations today. Members, in closing, I just want to recap a little bit. So today we learned about the importance of having one list that leads individuals to a credential of value. However, we've also seen from the materials before you that we are funding various credentials through funding lists, such as the CAPE Industry Certification funding list, and also through eligible training providers that are placing individuals into these programs. With this in mind, at our next meeting, we'll discuss how to fund credentials that truly provide value to Floridians and whether or not we need to reevaluate how we are currently funding these different programs, incentivizing students into these programs, and tracking the progress of the outcomes. Unfortunately, we don't have time to introduce ourselves today. I would like to recognize my ranking member, Dr. Bush. It's a great privilege for me to be able to have you here today, and then also my vice chair, Representative Schoaf. And Representative Bush, just tell us what district you're from and say hi. And we know you need a blessing, so we're good with that.
Well,
very quickly.
First off, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I'm looking forward to working with you, not only with you, but all the rest of the members, and hoping we can come up with some type of substantive legislation that can address the issues that's been presented before us today. With that being said, I still need a blessing.
Thank you. Representative Schoaf, would you like to say a word?
It's going to be a great year working with all of you. This is a passion of mine, and look forward to it.
Thank you. Members, one of the things that I'll do between now and the next time we meet is I'll make sure that I get on all of your all's schedules individually and get by and say hi to you and introduce myself. I would like to introduce our administrative assistants, who's Missy Jones is right back here with us, and then also Ms. Chris Sanchez is our policy chief. If you have any questions, you can certainly go to them, and they can help you maybe understand some of the things that were done. I've asked Ms. Sanchez to reach out to Ms. Benfield and to Mr. Krause to get their cliff notes, if you will, from their presentations that they made. I think that would be helpful for us, and so they'll be doing that. I appreciate y'all's participation. I look forward to working with all of you. I looked through some of your bios, and I know that you're all passionate about this issue, and so I'm really looking forward to it. And I think that we've got an opportunity to really move the needle, if you will, on career development for our students and Floridians in Florida, and so I'm really excited about it. With that being said, thank you for being here, and without objection, Vice Chair Schoaf moves that we rise, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.